Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today on Outside In is an author, an environmentalist, and a geographer. So someone who knows a thing or two about the world, I guess. And I he's here to talk about his new book, Carbon Choices. And I think one of the, if you're like me, you know, I'm increasingly concerned about the environment, but I find it all pretty confusing at times. And I think what Neil's done is to reduce or to try to bring the complex issues of climate change and what we're going to do about it to a level that maybe even people like me can understand it. So I'll introduce to the show Neil Kitching. Hello, Neil.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me on, John.
You're very welcome. And can I ask you, first of all, what you were an accountant at one point, or still are an accountant, I don't know. And I wondered, what got you interested in the environmental issues and climate change?
Yes, I was always a great lover of the outdoors and nature. I was brought up in Perth and was a regular hill walker and always out cycling or walking. Quite naturally went on to study geography at Edinburgh University, absolutely loved it, but came out 4 years later in the middle of a big recession, absolutely no jobs, and ended up working, training as an accountant in London, of all things. So,
oh, wow.
That was quite a shock to me.
Oh, I see. So you spent did you spend many years in London then?
I only survived 1 year in London and then 4 years in Sheffield, which I did quite enjoy Sheffield. But I was always desperate to move back to Scotland with a job as an accountant, and did that for 10, 20 years, but always had in the back of my mind that that wasn't really me.
Uh-huh.
So I managed to move into a sustainable development policy job, and I'm now happily working as an energy specialist.
Oh, right, that sounds fascinating. So tell us about your book then. I gave you a sort of a bit of a summary of what I thought it was about, but tell me what's at the heart of the book. What was your inspiration?
Just a feeling that so many people don't really understand climate change. I think fundamentally people of my generation weren't taught about it at school. Mm-hmm. So we all hear about climate change, but we get a lot of misinformation, and we might kind of know some of the facts, but we just don't know a lot about it. And it is the most important issue of the future. So yeah, I just felt I know a lot about this topic. It's frustrating that we're not, as a society, we're not doing enough to tackle climate change. So I really felt I should get something down in paper and try and make my mark.
And, good. And you
help in my own little way.
That's great. Your book came out, I think, the 12th of November. Is that right? It's out anyway. It's available now, isn't it?
It was out in October. That's right. Oh. It's available on Amazon, if I could just say that.
Of course you can. And what are the key principles that you explain in your book then?
The book's in three sections. The first section is the introduction to what is climate change, and it's I try to write it in a plain, easy to read language, because people need to understand that first. But going beyond that, the second section is identifying 10 building blocks that we really need to get in place as a society before we can even begin to tackle climate change.
So tell us about a few of those. What do you think are the key things that we need, that we actually need to have in place before we can effectively tackle what is, as you say, the biggest challenge to our civilization, really?
Yeah, I guess sensible economics is the first building block that we need to have in place and just isn't in place at the moment. So just a very basic thing that subsidies and taxes need to be aligned with climate change objectives. And sometimes at the moment, they're working in the wrong direction.
So things like I suppose the EU agricultural policy would perhaps be something that we're still under now. And is that something you'd like to see us get away from, or do you think that helps with climate change?
Well, the agricultural subsidies in the United Kingdom and in the EU have all been in the past about promoting more production. And that tends to be more fertilizer, more pesticides, more insecticides, more harm to the environment. So there's, you know, a great chance. I wasn't particularly in favor of Brexit, but it's maybe the one benefit is the United Kingdom does have a chance to reform our subsidies. We spend a lot of money on subsidies, and we really need to direct them for societal benefit.
Well, yes, I mean, our whole agricultural economy is basically based on subsidies. An awful lot of farming wouldn't happen if it wasn't for those subsidies. So I certainly think that's an important issue, isn't it?
Well, particularly in Scotland, a lot of our uplands, as you well know, are grazed by sheep, and there's a lot of cattle as well. And the problem with sheep and cattle is the ruminants, and they belch out methane in huge quantities. So they're a powerful contributor to greenhouse gases. And then sheep, of course, graze the ground so that no tree saplings can grow.
Yes.
You know, it's a difficult one because people like farmers. I mean, I don't like the idea of putting people out of work. We have to think as a society, is that the best use of our land? If we're going to change it, it's not a matter of, it's a matter of redirecting subsidies so that farmers would still get subsidies, but perhaps to do things that are more beneficial.
Beneficial to the environment, yeah. And does your book talk about what we as individuals can do?
It does. As I say, section 2 tackles the kind of societal issues, and then section 3 is how we'd put that into practice in our lives.
Oh, right. So to tell us a bit about that then, what can we do?
Oh gosh, there's so much. There's chapters on our homes and our buildings, how we, you know, our transport, obviously cars and trains and buses, and then in flying and tourism. Uh-huh. So really, the book covers a bit of everything. But right at the end, to try and summarise things, I do have a green action plan. I split that into 3, one for governments, one for businesses, and one for individuals.
I mean, do you think as individuals, we need to kind of like almost change our whole lifestyle? I mean, right now, you know, we used to jump in the car and go in wherever you want. But is that something we need to question?
Well, cars, there's a kind of technical solution that's maybe not perfect, but the move to electric vehicles will certainly reduce the impacts from cars. There's some areas of our lives that we could probably carry on much as before with technical solutions. I mean, technology and innovation is amazing what it can deliver. But things like our diets, that's something that our personal choices are really important. And then things like flying, there's no technical solutions coming up in the next 30 to 40 years.
Not really,
It's going to give us zero carbon flying. So flying is another issue where behavior choice is really important.
Okay. I mean, in terms of diet, do we all need to be vegans, basically? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't go as far as that. But I do emphasize in the book that we should shift our diets towards more plant-based diets, and really meat, and particularly beef and mutton, for the reasons I gave earlier, should be seen as treats, not something that we're eating. We shouldn't be having beef burgers. Well, in my view, shouldn't be having beef burgers every day. It should be seen as a treat, and hopefully high quality meat as well.
So basically, you're talking about as eating a lot less meat, but the meat we eat being reared in a far more environmentally sensitive technique. Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. I think that has benefits for the environment, for farmers as well, who can sell a quality product at a better price, and good for our health and diets as well.
I certainly have, I've heard some environmentalists argue that basically the way we're farming at the moment is almost completely unsustainable, and that I suppose we've basically all got to live off tofu in the future. I don't know how that. Did you think it needs to be as extreme as that? Because there are people who argue that basically we have to stop eating meat completely.
I don't go as far as that. I think that's a very uncomfortable message for our society. But absolutely, we should be moving more towards a plant-based diet.
Well, I mean, some of the messages are uncomfortable, aren't they? I mean, for people who, as you say, people who are frequent flyers, and there's a lot of people whose holidays, until lockdown at least, have involved flights quite frequently, and. One of the things, I suppose, paradoxically, one of the things that the COVID-19 pandemic has done is, in some ways, I suppose, in reducing the amount of aircraft flying, it's actually helped the environment.
Well, of course it has, but not in the way any of us planned, or really in the way any of us wanted. Aviation, in my view, should be tackled through taxes and subsidies, basically. At the moment, aviation fuel isn't taxed because it's an international commodity and there's no international taxes in place. So it's just ridiculous. We don't tax something that we know is polluting, and that encourages us all to fly. The number of flights, I mean, people in the United Kingdom fly almost more than people in any other country in the world. And it's all happened in the last 20 or 30 years.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's right, actually. Yeah, it has. I mean, I can remember when I'm old enough to remember when I didn't know anybody who'd flown in an aircraft, you know.
Within that, the number of flights, it's a small number of people who do a lot of flights. And right, so there's been proposals for a frequent flyer tax or something like that, which wouldn't affect people who want to go on a one family holiday a year, but it would affect the frequent flyers who are just flying excessively. That's the bottom line.
Right. Okay. And those taxes could be used to, there's a possibility to keep, as you say, some of the wilder parts of Scotland I think it's called carbon sequestration. Is that correct?
There's a number of words for it, but carbon offsetting or carbon sequestration. So yeah, the taxes from aviation should, in my view, then be spent on beneficial things and trying to remove carbon from the atmosphere through nature.
Can you explain? I've never really fully understood, to be honest, how carbon sequestration works. Can you give us an explanation? You're the man to ask, I think. Can you explain in ways that I can understand how carbon sequestration works?
Well, there's far more carbon dioxide, carbon in the soils than there is in the atmosphere. And also in trees. So the clearest example is to plant more trees. Trees are made of carbon predominantly. So by planting more trees, you remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And as long as those trees remain forested, then that's kind of removed for a very long time. Well, in Scotland as well, of course, we have masses of peatlands, and peatlands are like 90% carbon. So we really want to stop those peatlands from eroding and try and protect them and help them build up very slowly over time. But that certainly stores away carbon on a permanent basis.
So essentially what you would do is tax frequent flyers and use that money to promote forestry and peatlands, which would I suppose absorb some of the carbon that the people are producing by flying. Is it a kind of balance? Is that really what it's about?
Well, I do have a bit of skepticism about the whole carbon offsetting, and then the whole chapter in my book about it. It's a step in the right direction.
I mean, I realise the difficult bit is I'm trying to we're talking in a few minutes and simplifying things, which are pretty complicated. So it may be a bit tricky to do. What other things have you did in your action plan for people then? What other things do you think are key?
I think planning and housing is important. So much of our lives is dependent on where we live.
Yes.
To some extent, we choose where we live, but to some extent, we're kind of pushed and pulled by society and market forces.
Yeah.
So I'm really quite against building new houses in the countryside. New houses built today, still connected to the gas grid,
right.
which I find ridiculous. We need to wean ourselves off gas. But if you build new houses in the countryside, you then become completely car dependent.
Well, that's true.
So you're building in a whole society that's based on carbon emissions. Obviously, the rural areas might need new houses, but roundabout cities, we should be refurbishing existing buildings and building better quality within cities.
I did see a feature on that replacing. I mean, obviously, I've got a gas boiler myself. I've got to confess, you know. But there are schemes about, I understand, to replace those with things like heat pumps. I don't fully understand how they work, to be honest. But one of the things I heard was that the cost was something like £15,000 per home. How do you think that is practical then? What do you think, or how do you think that might work?
It goes back to my building blocks. It's not practical for you as an individual at the moment to replace your gas boiler with a heat pump. Just economically not sensible. So we need to get everything right. Firstly, gas is ridiculously cheap. It's barely taxed at all.
Yeah.
Electricity is taxed far more highly than gas.
I didn't know that. Is that right? I didn't know that. I wasn't aware.
Yeah, it's just UK government rules. So heat pumps work off electricity, so we need to change that balance. We shift some of the taxes from electricity to gas, and that would help to favour the economics of heat pumps.
And so in terms of how heat pumps work, how do they work compared to boilers then? What's the difference between the two, gas boilers?
Yeah, well, I'm not an engineer, but gas boilers burn things and give off carbon dioxide or methane in the process. Heat pumps use electricity and they're sometimes described as a fridge in reverse. If you put your hand in the back of the fridge, it's really warm. And so they're using compression. I can't really explain.
That's okay. So they
piece
take
of magic.
They work by magic. I think we can both relate to that. That's fine. No, but essentially, what they do is, my understanding, I don't really understand it. Is they take latent heat out of the earth, and somehow use that to heat your house, basically.
Well, you get ground source heat pumps that take the heat from the earth, and you get air source heat pumps that take heat from the air, and water source heat pumps, which clearly take heat from the water. And the great thing is, for every unit of electricity put into a heat pump, you can get 3 or 4 units of useful heat out, because it's taking the heat from the atmosphere or from the ground and boosting it to a useful temperature.
And this is probably going to offer a bit of a tangent. What's your view about nuclear power?
Slightly agnostic about it. One of my principles is that we should think for the long term.
Right, right.
It's a huge concern to me that our nuclear waste might still be a problem in 10,000 years' time. I don't think that's really fair on future generations.
Yeah.
But on the other side, I don't want to suddenly close down all nuclear power stations, because all that would happen is we'd start burning more coal or gas. So,
well, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
That would be good.
In the short term, they're a relatively clean source of energy. Is that right? That's my understanding.
Certainly very clean as they produce electricity. But you've got to remember that there's a lot of waste and a lot of energy used to mine the uranium. That could leave a radioactive debris in the around about the uranium mines.
I see. Okay.
But yeah, my concern is more about the long term. We have nuclear power stations by the coast.
Mm-hmm.
All the predictions are that the sea levels will rise over the centuries. So these nuclear facilities could be a huge liability and a huge problem in the future.
What's the main, obviously, well, the government talks a lot about climate change, and we've got the, there's the climate change summit coming, is that, that's correct? It was postponed this year, but it's going to be, it's in Scotland, is it? I'm not quite too sure.
Yeah, so COP26 is the global climate change conference that was supposed to be held this month in Glasgow.
Right.
It's been postponed for a year to November next year.
Right, right.
And that will be the perhaps the most important climate conference or conference of any kind held
right.
anywhere. So it's quite amazing. It's coming to Glasgow, not too far from where I live.
Oh, right. So and well, as far as the climate's concerned, the Earth's environment, I think possibly Mr. Trump's exit from the White House, if they can get him to go, do you think that's probably a good thing for the environment?
Well, I wouldn't want to comment too much on particular politics, but clearly any party that's planning and promising to do more in the climate is a good thing.
So Mr. Trump not being at this conference, I think, might be quite a good thing, really. I don't know. And what's the major step that do you think that the kind of policies that we're bringing in at the moment are going in the right direction to deal with or at least try and deal with climate change? Or do you think that there needs to be are we not doing enough? Or do you think where do you think we are on a sort of that kind of scale at the moment?
We are definitely not doing enough. There's no doubt about that. On the other side, we are moving in the right direction, but too little, too slow. So going back, we're building tens of thousands of new houses, often in green belts, all attached to the gas grid. And it's just doesn't make any sense. We're going to be having to rip out the gas grid probably in 10, 20 years' time once we realize that that's the only way to get to net zero. So.
And is that the biggest thing you think we can do, really, is to for everybody's homes to stop burning gas? Is that really the biggest one of the biggest contributions anyway?
Oh, it's one of them, but a shift in our diets would be a really important factor too. A shift in our travel habits, a move to electric vehicles. But just on that, the move to electric vehicles, you can kind of see a pathway for it.
Yes.
And obviously there's a new announcement of no new petrol or diesel cars by 2030. But I don't see a clear pathway for stopping burning gas in our homes.
I mean, it's a much
more difficult problem.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's vast, really. And what's your? This is a difficult question. What's your prediction? Where do you think we're going to be in, say, 20 years' time?
Oh gosh, I think Britain will be well on the path towards our net zero targets. I think we are taking it seriously.
Right.
So if you think about cities, we'll have majority of electric vehicles, and that'll have great advantages for it'll be quieter. And obviously less air pollution. So big health benefits as well. I mean, that's one of the things about this. It's not just about carbon emissions, it's about health, it's about diets, it's about air pollution. So I just see lots of positive things in this. We mentioned rewilding earlier on. I can see companies who are trying to get to net zero spending lots of money on nature-based solutions, and that can only be good.
Yes. So we're moving gradually in the right direction, but obviously what happens in Britain is only a small part of the picture. I mean, you know, we talk about the rises in sea levels and you can see right now. I mean, it's obviously you live in Scotland, so if you go out in the outdoors, you're well aware of the climate, and climate change is just, well, I see it every day. And our weather patterns are changing dramatically with more and more severe weather. Do you think that will continue to be an issue in say 10, 20 years' time?
Yes, I think that's kind of unstoppable. So we're going to have to learn to live with that. The things I've noticed are the increase in heavy rainfall, both summer storms, thunderstorms, but also winter, long periods of rainfall when everything turns to mud. Yes. And, you know, one of the consequences is landslips. So roads and railway lines blocked by landslips. I don't remember that as a child, but it's something, you know, I hear about every year.
Which is also a consequence of deforestation, isn't it?
It is, but we were just as deforested 20, 30 years ago.
Well, actually, we're probably more, weren't we? You're right, actually. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so, it's probably a consequence of just the sheer amount of energy around in the weather systems. I certainly noticed that. It seems to be windier and wilder than it used to be. And sadly less cold, because I used to enjoy our cold winters, but they are fewer and fewer recently. I don't know if that's been your experience.
Yeah, so last winter, we didn't have snow in our garden, or maybe we did one day only. And that's been the least snow on record in my lifetime, living in Perth and then Dunblane. So that's been a huge difference. There was a lot of snow in the mountains, but that all came late and all high up in the mountains. And that's because there was a lot more precipitation, and some of it did eventually fall as snow.
It did, but it, as you say, it was a lot of it was soft and unconsolidated and just didn't hang around. But we did get a brief snap of winter. I think I was fortunate enough to be out in it, you know. But that's all we've had so far. So not all. You don't seem to be totally pessimistic. You seem to think that there are some possibilities for improvement. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's a very difficult subject. It's very easy when you study climate change to get very doom and gloom. But the changes that I think we should be making are generally good for society for all sorts of reasons. And then globally, you mentioned the American elections. We have a new president who's promising new climate targets. We had the Chinese 2 or 3 weeks ago, promising net zero by 2060. I mean, these are huge changes, and they have a knock-on impact because they then encourage other changes to make similar promises. It needs a global effort.
Well, we've certainly covered some huge topics in a very short time. But your book's available on Amazon. It's called Carbon Choices. But there's a subtitle, isn't there? What's the subtitle of the book?
Yeah, subtitle: Common Sense Solutions to a Climate and Nature Crisis. So that's very deliberate. Common sense, because I think a lot of the solutions are common sense if we step back to think about them, you know, when I mentioned taxes and subsidies. And it covers climate and nature, because really the two are intertwined. There'd be no point in solving our climate crisis if we manage to wipe out nature in the process. So
absolutely, which we've done a pretty good job of doing so far, to be quite honest, haven't we? We've not really helped our natural environment very much until fairly recently. Well, that was fascinating, Neil. Thanks very much for coming on the show. And if people want to find out more, they can pop along to Amazon, and I'll put a link to your book on the podcast page. And I think common sense solutions to our climate change problems, you know, they have to be something that we all want, we all need. So thanks very much for coming. Nice to have you on the show.
Okay, thanks, John. Enjoyed that.
Okay, bye-bye then. Thank you.